JesusRising.com.
Amos Davidovits is the son of Moshe Dror, who we've interviewed several times on this station and whose blogs have appeared, and where Moshe lives in the small town of Yerucham. Amos lives on Kibbutz Gezer. How long have you been in Kibbutz, Nick, Amos?
I've been living in Gezer since 1984.
And what kind of work have you done there?
When it was a traditional kibbutz, you used to do anything. I was everything, actually. I ran the garage. I was a welder. I drove a truck. I did pest control in the cotton. I worked in the kindergarten. I was the work manager. I worked in the dairy. And I fixed the bicycles and all kinds of different things.
One of the reasons that I asked you to be interviewed is a document you wrote several years ago, An Ethical Will to Your Children. And in the document, you explain that you were a major in the reserves and had done quite a bit of reserve duty. And I'm wondering, and you also were involved in the peace movement. And I'm wondering if on your way to becoming a major, when you were a captain or a lieutenant, if you found yourself in a situation where you were receiving orders that you had to pass down to your men, which you found difficult to fulfill because of political or ethical reasons?
There aren't really... I don't think that there's room for political questions within the army. And thankfully, the Israeli army, if you read the basic orders of the Israeli army, they're all very moral and very much in line with what I would like to see. For example, it says in the standing orders of the army that if you have to stop somebody and you have to talk to them, you have to, like, you need their ID or something like that, that you have to be polite and you have to be courteous and so on and so forth. Needless to say, that doesn't exactly happen all of the time. And so within the framework of the army, within the standing orders, within the when people were sitting in the room and under, you know, lights, and they had a, you know, hot piping cup of tea or coffee, what they wrote was something that I can definitely live with. The problem is not that. The problem is what happens on the ground. One of my major tasks as a major, major from Catch-22, is that I think that my job is to protect my soldiers from the army. The army is a huge organization, and they don't take into consideration enough what the grunt has to do in the field. Besides that, there's also, they have to cover their butts and make sure that they don't get into trouble. And so therefore, they hand out all kinds of orders that everybody knows that nobody's doing them, but they're written there anyhow, and everybody, you know, reads them out, so, you know, they'll be able to say, oh, I told them, but they didn't do it. So I think that that's an inappropriate situation. So I usually tell them, this is what the army says, this is what I tell you to do, you do what I tell you, and then I'll take care of you. If you don't, then it's your problem. So I haven't had that many moral issues or political issues. In my unit, we have soldiers of every political persuasion serving, and there's usually never any debate. We deal with our military goals in a professional manner that has politics aren't involved. The problems that do arise is that when my commanding officer would give me an order that I consider just to be sheer idiocy, not necessarily morally wrong or politically wrong, just militarily wrong, and then you have to carry those out unless I can manage to persuade them otherwise. There's been a bunch of things of that nature. And then there's the basic issue of the army. I mean, the army doesn't produce anything. The army, no matter how nice you want to put it, basically deals with killing other people, or at least bringing about a situation where they get to kill you or whoever you're supposed to be protecting. And when I was a second lieutenant, when I just started out, as an officer, and I was training new recruits, I had a moral dilemma. If I'm supposed to be teaching my soldiers to kill the enemy, and the enemy is faceless, and they're just people wearing a different colored uniform, or I'm going to teach them to kill Ahmad, who is a person who just finished, you know, fixing the carburetor on his car, and his dog just had puppies, and he wants to go and study, you know, whatever. So I, after a long debate with myself, in the end, I decided that I was going to teach. First, I was going to teach my soldiers to kill the enemy, because I'm responsible for my soldiers, and I have to bring them back to their families, and I have no idea what the Syrian, Lebanese, Egyptian officer is teaching his soldiers. And after I get them to do that and do it well, then maybe we'll start dealing with that the soldiers, the enemy soldier actually has a name and has a family, and so on. And it's a very different level, being able to pull the trigger with an enemy soldier in your sights is one level of consciousness, and being able to pull the trigger with Ahmad in your sights, knowing that you're going to make somebody, some kid, an orphan, is a completely different level of consciousness. And most people can't do that, or have a very hard time doing that. And even if the hard time only translates into, you know, 5 seconds, that's the 5 seconds that can get your guy killed instead of getting him killed. And that's what most armies do. Most armies train you to kill, you know, the Japs or the Krauts or the, you know, whoever they happen to be, who your enemy happens to be. They're not people. They are just the enemy.
And when you mentioned in your paper your work in the peace movement, what does that entail?
I wouldn't say that I'm work in the peace movement. I don't consider myself to be a peace activist. My understanding of this is less political and much more Jewish. Life divides itself into two separate options. Either you're doing tikkun olam, you're mending the world, or primato shel olam, or you're tearing it asunder. And every action you do, or majority of them at least, you should decide what do you want to do. You want to do this or you want to do that. And so I do what I understand to be the right thing. So if I think that, for example, a few years ago, a friend of mine who's living in Gaza, the situation in Gaza was very, very difficult, and he said that there's about to be the holiday and people don't have food to eat, Eid al-Fitr, there's no food. So he said, find me some money so I can buy people food. That's not part of the peace. I'm not a peace activist doing this. I'm a Jew doing tikkun olam and feeding people who are hungry and on their holiday. So it's even more of a mitzvah. That they happen to be Muslim is that they happen to be Muslim. That's irrelevant. God, I don't think, really cares if it's a Jewish kid or a Muslim kid or a Hindi kid or a Shinto kid or whatever. It's kids are kids or people are people. We don't get the choice what God will put in front of our path. We only get the choice of how we're going to relate to what God puts in front of our path. And since I've over the years developed a certain proficiency in being able to organize things that other people can't organize, and I've done this in Israel and I've done this abroad, it's things that have nothing at all to do with Israel, in Cyprus and in Uzbekistan and a water problem in Somalia and all kinds of things like that. So since it's something that I can do and I can do well, I continue doing it. Things arise. You don't have to go and look out, you know, try to seek out these things that have to be fixed. There's more than enough of them all the time, wherever you turn. And it's not only these type of things, because I used to deal with juvenile delinquents, and I dealt with things that between religious and non-religious, and all kinds of other things, and the environment, and so on. So I don't exactly consider myself a peace activist, although most other people would say that I am. Simply think that I do what I think considered is to be the right thing. In the long run, in a metaphorical way, and maybe it's not metaphorical, I don't know, a person has to live their life that when they get up to the pearly gates, either they say, well, this is what I did, and this is the mitigating circumstances, and here I didn't really mean it, but it came out wrong. If you're saying that, then you're leading your life wrong. You're not doing it in a proper way. You should be able to get up to the pearly gates and say, this is what I did. I did the best that I could. Do whatever you want. So that's the way I look at it.
You connect the part of being Jewish and the part of being a Zionist and living in Israel with this tikkun olam, with this work that you do.
I think it's all connected. It's also my military service is connected. It's all connected. As far as I understand, and I don't profess to be a great Jewish scholar, although there have been a bunch of them in my in the history of my family, but it's not me. I think Judaism is a community religion. It's based on community. My service in the army is my responsibility towards my community. And you, whatever you do, if you're already going to do it, you might as well do it well, so I'm an officer. Because even though I've already finished doing my mandatory service, and I've been volunteering for a few years, because I know that when I'm in the army and I'm giving the orders and my soldiers are, you know, doing what I tell them to do, there's more of a chance that we will ourselves incur less harm upon ourselves and also upon our adversaries or whatever whoever we're dealing with. And so the same thing with the peace activities. It's very very clear in the Bible. I do pshat. I do the simple stuff. It's written in the Bible, and it says you're supposed to treat the widow and the orphan and the foreigner, the ger yitolm almana, with respect and with honor, and you're supposed to provide for them. So I mean, it's very clear. It's not. I mean, it doesn't even need, you know. It's there.
How do you see the reality that we're experiencing now between the recent Annapolis conference, the current Prime Minister of Israel, the current Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority? Do you see anything positive coming out of these encounters?
First of all, basically, I'm an optimist. I think that there are many issues and many problems. But one thing that I think I know for sure, because I've taught people from all around the world, and I've dealt a lot with Palestinians and a lot with Israelis, people want to live their lives. And they want to be able to know that they can raise their children, and that if they put some money in the bank, it's going to be there 5 or 10 years from now, and they'll be able to build a house and make long-term plans. Palestinians don't make long-term plans. They simply don't. They don't even make mid-term plans. For example, Palestinians don't go on honeymoons after they're married because they can't get out. There's no place to go. For us, that's something, you know, matter of fact, of course. You know, again, going to get married, we're going to go, maybe we go to, you know, Paris, or we'll go to Caracas, or we'll go to New Delhi, but we're going to go someplace because that's what people do. Palestinians don't. I think that if it was up to the people, then I don't know if peace, as I would like to see peace, could be arranged, but let's say a status quo of non-belligerence could end, and economic ties and cultural ties could be organized within 6 weeks. Since it's politicians, and politicians have other different agenda besides what they say, they have a whole different agenda, so it's probably going to take 10 years. But I think that there's an underlying desire and need for there to be some type of agreement and less bloodshed. And that's for a bunch of different reasons. What I think scares the Muslim world the most now, and the Arab Muslim world most now, are the Shiite Persians. The Iranians are not Arabs, they're Persians. And they're not Sunni like the majority of the Arab world, they're Shiite. The Shiites have a completely different take on religion, on Islam, and they have two strains of thought or two extra things in their basis of the religion that the Sunni don't have. First of all, is that for them, Jerusalem is not important. It's almost of no significance whatsoever. What's important is Karbala, where Hussein was killed, the grandson of Ali. So this whole area for them is of less importance. And the other thing is that, as far as they're concerned, the end of time will come only when the Sunnis convert to Shiites and everybody else converts to Islam and then to Shiite Islam. If all of the Christians and all, if everybody converted to Islam, but it would be Sunni Islam, it's not over as far as they're concerned. And they're allowed, because they've always been a minority, and they've, within the Arab world and within the Islamic world, and since they've always been persecuted, they're allowed to retaliate in ways that the Sunni Muslims aren't. And it's interesting. For example, suicide bombing. When they were fighting with Iraq, it was fine for them, from a theological point of view, to send people out and to step on the landmines in order to clear the way. But that's not appropriate for Sunnis. And it's recently there was a whole debate in the Sunni in Egypt, where the big theological centers are, about the Palestinian suicide bombers. How can we say that's okay, because you're not allowed to commit suicide in this, according to the Islam, the Sunni Islam. And they said, well, it's an interim step, because they couldn't fight it because there was so much of it going on. So I think that, so number one, I think that people basically want to get along. Number two, globalization and international pressure is such that the Israelis and the Palestinians are going to have to bend someplace and come to some agreement that will allow the world to interact with us, because right now that's a real, it's a problem. The world finds it difficult to interact with us. I think that and I think that we'll come to some type of agreement. I think, but for us as Israelis, I think one of the big problems is not this and not that. One of the big problems is that in the year 2002, the UNDP, the United Nations Development Program, wrote a report that was headed by they're all Arab scholars, headed by an Egyptian, which I don't recall his name right now, but it was the United Nations Development Program's report on the Arab world. And it turns out, to my surprise, that the Arab world is the most illiterate, with the worst, the least democracy, the poorest, with the biggest gaps between the poor and the rich, and with the worst women's rights situation. I would think that, like, maybe Africa would be poor, but the Arab world is the poorest segment of humanity. And with media as it is now, and globalization and so on and so forth, in the end, these people are going to say, enough of this stuff. We want something else. And which is going to cause unrest within the Arab world. And when there's unrest in the Arab world, we know who gets the benefit from that. And we see that all the time, because if you look, all of our Arab nations, our Arab neighbors, are a minority ruling a majority. And whenever there's instability, it pours out into our border, like Lebanon, or like Jordan before that. And when that happens, we're going to have a big problem. And I don't know exactly even how to stage ourselves in order to deal with that. It's going to sweep across the Maghreb, and it's going to sweep across the Levant, and it's going to be all over the place. And if you take into consideration other things that are happening, such as the global warming, and there's going to be less water, and the coast of the plains are all going to be flooded, and it's going to make it even... it's going to magnify the problems. So I think that on the level of the neighborhood, the Palestinians and the Israelis, everybody knows what's going to happen. There's going to have to be, because through the different peace initiatives that have happened till now, if it's the Oslo agreements or the Geneva Accords or the roadmap or what the UN or what Blair or what everybody says, the Israelis are going to have to give up control of a lot of the West Bank. And the Palestinians are going to have to find some way in order to curb the violence within their own society and towards us. And that's what the situation is going to be. Either we're going to go there, I don't know, I wouldn't say exactly walking hand in hand, you know, skipping into the sunset, or we'll be dragged there by our by the U.S. and by Europe. But in the end, we're going to go there. And de facto, that's the situation. Somebody once asked, how are we going to divide Jerusalem? They said, it's real simple. Phone an address, and if they answer in Hebrew, then it's Israeli. If they answer in Arabic, it's going to be Palestinian.
To bring it a little closer, how do you see what's going on in Israel today within Israel, in Israeli society, which I assume you also pay attention to?
I think that there's a few issues that Israeli society is dealing with, not only Israeli society, but since we're so intense and it's such a, and the world looks at us more than they would look at any other place on the planet, and since we're the only country in the world that was founded on ideology, which makes us unique. I mean, there's, you can say that, like, Nicaragua after the Sandinistas was founded on some type of ideology, but it wasn't. There was Nicaragua, and then along came the Sandinistas, and their ideology didn't last. So there's a few issues happening that are affecting our society. I think, and they touch us to the level of the ethos of Zionism. The first thing is that the idea of early Zionism, or let's say the beginning of the 20th century Zionism, was a socialist ethic. And the whole idea of Borukhov, of turning over the occupational triangle, in the Borukhov's idea was that a normal society has 60% farmers and 35%, let's say, industrial workers and 5% professionals, except the Jews, who was different in Europe. It had a minuscule amount of farmers, a small amount of industrialists or proletariat, and a very large amount of professionals. And the idea of the early socialist Zionism was to turn it over and make us like a normal people. And, for example, there are many stories of people who were doctors and lawyers and professors, and they came to Israel and they refused to practice their trade. They wanted to be farmers. They wanted to plow the land. They wanted to milk the cows. They wanted to guard the Jewish settlements. Well, lo and behold, everybody's turned Jewish. The modern structure, economic structure now, let's say in the States or in Western Europe, is between 1% and 1.5% farmers, except for in places where there's anomaly, like in France, because there's such a large subsidy of the farmers. But it's more or less a percentage, 1.5%, maybe 3%, who are farmers. And then you have somewhere between 13% and 17% who are industrial workers, and everybody else now is professionals. So the ethos of what our country was founded on has simply become irrelevant. So that's one type of issue, which is very problematic. It's especially problematic, for example, for kibbutznikim, right? Because the whole kibbutz was based on the idea of turning the lawyers into farmers. And if you want to make money nowadays, you sit at home with a computer and you do something that makes money. You provide a service of some sort. You don't plow the land. And so that's one aspect of it. Now within that aspect, even if you do want to plow the land, when the kibbutz movement started, you used to plow with a donkey, and you'd pull a little, you know, wooden metal plow behind you. Now you take a John Deere that has a 12-meter plow behind you. Instead of plowing the top, you know, 10 centimeters of soil, you plow 40 centimeters of soil. And so the whole, you just need less of people doing everything. That's one part of the issue. So the whole idea, or the whole ethos of returning to the land and becoming farmers and so on, has become irrelevant. If you want to have an economy that's viable, and we don't want to be Malaysia, we want to be, Western Europe or the United States or something like that. We want to belong to the OECD. We don't want to belong to the developing nations. Then another issue is the whole issue of land. In the past, the only way to get from one place to another was to walk. And if you didn't walk, then you took a donkey. And land had a very, very important both symbolic meaning and also a strategic meaning. But that's not the situation anymore. ICBM's already old hat, but, you know, with cruise missiles and all kinds of this other equipment, it doesn't matter where you sit. You can sit in on an aircraft carrier in the middle of nowhere, and you press a button, and then you blow up a building that's 8,000 miles away. And so the issue of land and the necessity to hold land in order to protect yourself has changed. So that's another issue. Besides that, there's another issue of the ethos, which was that it's very clear Israel is the only only country that's founded on ideology, as I said beforehand. And everything that happened in the country was based on ideology. You went to a youth movement according to your ideology. Either you went to Beitar or you went to Hashomer Tzair. And if you went to Beitar, that means that your family lived in a certain neighborhood. And that means that you supported a certain sports group. You didn't, if you were in Hashomer Tzair, you couldn't, wouldn't, didn't, wouldn't cross your mind to support Beitar Yerushalayim. You'd support Hapoel this or Hapoel that. And then you served in certain places in the army, and so on. So everything was ideology. And because Israel was under such pressure in its early stages until 1967, there was a very strong collective feeling and collective effort. There are stories of Dina Tnua, the call of the movement. When I came to kibbutz, or before that, of course, also. If the movement told you that you have to leave your family and go smuggle in refugees from Europe, then you got up and you went. And it would be an honor that the movement asked you to do it. And there was never any question whatsoever. Or if the movement told you that you're going to now go, settle a kibbutz in the desert someplace, then you got up and went because the movement told you what to do. And it was a very industrial way of thinking because the Israel was founded during the Industrial Revolution. The kibbutz is a response, for example, the kibbutz is a response to the situation within industrial society. And it was very task-oriented. Kibbutz was an Israeli society, was, and there was a collective effort, and there was more or less, it was type of Taylorism. Ben-Gurion was the guy who knew what had to be done, and then everybody did whatever Ben-Gurion told them to do. And that was true until 1967. Because until 1967, the country didn't feel that its survival was for sure. After the war in 1967, when Israel won the Six-Day War, people started feeling, okay, we've given 100% to the country now. Now the situation is such that we can give, only, 80%, and we'll start pursuing our own personal goals. And you see a lot of cracks in Israeli society. Maybe one of the easiest ways of seeing it is if you look at advertisements. For example, cigarette advertisements. If you look at cigarette advertisements during the 40s, then everybody's sitting around the campfire, they're passing around the coffee, somebody's playing the harmonica, not the harmonica, the accordion, and they're smoking, Ascot cigarettes. During the 50s, it's somebody's, building the Movila Otsi, the national water carrier, or is building a road, or building this, or building that. Very Soviet-style advertising. And they're sitting, so there's a few of them, holding a hammer or a scythe or something like that, smoking cigarettes. And during the 60s, you see a picture of soldiers, protecting, doing this or doing that, and they're smoking cigarettes. During the 70s, it's already somebody hanging out at a restaurant or something, drinking drinking coffee and smoking a cigarette. And during the 80s, it's somebody, a half-naked woman lying over a BMW and the guy standing there leaning on the car smoking a cigarette. It's a completely different ethos. And so until 1967, it was very collective. After 1967, people started feeling that that the place is secure enough that they can pursue their own personal goals. And that's when the expression Hagshama Atzmit, personal fulfillment, came into the dialogue of Israeli society. Before that, there was Dina Tnua, the call of the movement. And then afterwards, it became personal fulfillment. In 1973, after the Yom Kippur War, two things shadowed within Israeli society, and two things changed within the ethos that made a significant difference. The first one was that people no longer believed authority. They started questioning authority because of the outcome of the Yom Kippur War, and so now it's almost impossible to the movement wouldn't call you anymore because you didn't believe anybody. And the second thing is that even though the war was politically lost, it was militarily won. And people thought, well, before, if it wasn't clear that we're going to survive, now it's really clear. If they didn't manage to wipe us out in 73, now it's so now it's for sure. So then now people didn't believe in their leadership, and they didn't believe that they were looking out for them. They didn't believe in their decision-making process, so we're not going to look at them. And now it's already clear that nobody's going to wipe us out, and we can go and mind our own business and take care of ourselves, because it's clear that they're not going to take care of us. The government isn't going to take care of us. And so that process that's been, has been going on within Israeli society. And then there's globalization. There's globalization affects us like it affects everybody else. And we're no longer a tiny little community. We're part of the international community. And so all of these things together have opened up Israeli society and opened up the individual in order to do things that they otherwise might not have done. And the national ethos is no longer as strong, because now you also have, you're hearing other people's stories, other people's narratives, other people's perspectives on life, and people think that it's something else. And that's one of the things that you see in Israeli society when the young people go out and they travel all around the world. They want to see what's happening in other places. Ironically, a friend of mine who lives in Gaza says that they shouldn't have military service in Gaza. They should make it mandatory for every kid when they reach the age of 18 to travel around the world for 3 months. The government should pay for it so they get to see what happens outside of Gaza. Because among the Arabs, so the Palestinians. The Palestinian kids, everyone when they reach the age of 18 should travel around the world. Because when you live in Gaza, it's such a closed and area, and you can't see any. You don't see anything. You don't know what's going on in the world. I mean, you've never seen a mountain. And there's no way you're going to see a mountain your whole life because you live inside of Gaza. You see the sea, but you haven't seen a mountain. You haven't seen a forest. You haven't seen people sitting around in a cafe laughing and having fun. So within Israeli society, people are going out in order to see other things. And all these different things are happening, and we haven't managed to coalesce around a new ethos. There has to, a society should have a goal. So we can't say it's Judaism, because we're used to the Orthodox Judaism, which is very closed, and it's anachronistic for most of us. My wife, when she gave birth to our first child, she was sitting in the room after recuperating and nursing the baby. And next to her, there was a religious woman who just had a baby also. Her husband wouldn't even come and visit because she was unclean. And besides that, the woman was sitting there and saying to her daughter again and again, and God willing, the temple will be rebuilt and we'll be able to sacrifice in the temple again. And my wife is sitting there saying, like, sacrifice in the temple? You're going to take this little goat and slit its throat and spread its blood on the, you know, on the... It's irrelevant to most of us. Not to all of us, but to most of us. So it's not going to be that. We expect there to be more than just paying taxes and serving the military. And we haven't found what that is, and there's a void. I can tell you, I was doing reserve duty one day, and we're dealing with the families of Palestinians who were detained in Israeli detention centers. And this soldier, a young guy, he's walking there, and his pants, you know, fashion now, the pants are like half down their butt. And I go to the guy and I say, listen, you're dealing with civilians. You know, pick up your pants. You look like a slob. And he says to me, his typical Middle Eastern hand emotions, he says, who are you? I said, what do you mean, who am I? I'm twice your age, and I'm a major, and you're a corporal. And he says, He goes like, brushes me aside. So I phoned his commander, and he got on the bus to take these guys someplace. So I phoned his commander. I said, tell me within half an hour what the result of you guys, you have to court-martial this guy, or else I'm going to send him to jail. I'll send him for 35 days to jail and give him something to think about. I would never consider thinking about talking to a person who's clearly older than I am. I was then like 45 and he was 19. I would never consider talking to somebody like that, a person older than I. Never wouldn't cross my mind. Not to mention that I'm a major and he's a corporal. That's less significant from the point of view, but that that there's some educational problem here. What bothers me, or what I think is problematic in our society nowadays, is that there's a lack of clear values. Globalization probably also has something to do with it, or the free flow of information from side to side, and then we can take this and maybe take that, has probably something to do with it. And the way things have been given to us or passed down to us, the way we were educated, is also part of the problem. Because what I tell people when I talk about Israel and about Judaism and about Israelis being here, or Jews being here, there's something that's fundamental that I think is important to understand. That is, an environment creates a culture. Eskimos have 36 words for snow or something like that, and the Arabs have, I don't know how many words for camels, and we have a bunch of words for camels also. Americans don't have, and I doubt that the Eskimos have even one. Maybe they have camel, but, you know. All of our culture... Excuse me, not all of our culture. The basis of our culture was here, was created in this region. Before we were talking about the difference between the desert and the forest. Abraham sat in an open tent because you couldn't sit in a closed tent. You'd boil. So anybody was passing by, he would see them. And so when the angels passed by, he saw them. And you see somebody walking through the desert, and it's a hot day, so you invite them in. And they come in, you don't even have to open the door. As opposed to, let's say, my grandparents and the 700 years of my family living in Poland, it's the exact opposite. You have to have a closed house because you have rain and you have snow. And you have to knock on the door in order to come in. There was no door to knock on in the tent. The tent was always open. In Poland, the door was always closed, or else you'd freeze. So... our culture, our holidays, a lot of our expressions, and all of the biblical stuff come from this environment, and it was created here. As opposed, even though I was born in the States, and my parents came from my parents came from the States also, but their parents came from Eastern Europe. The only place I can find where Amos walked, Amos the prophet, is here. There's no other place. I can only understand his prophecy, or even the parables of Jesus, with the mustard seed and so on. You can understand that here. It doesn't make sense in Poland, doesn't make sense in the Andes, and it doesn't make sense in Antarctica. We have to find a way. What I understand, in some way, in order to fulfill your Jewishness, and understand your Jewishness. If I don't know if you have to live here, but you have to have been here. You have to have taken in the smells and seen the scenery and see the mountains and see the plants and absorb them in order to understand what it's about and where it comes from. We have to come up with some ethos and some existential meaning to this and pass that on from generation to generation. The Iroquois nations of the state in the United States, the Indians, they have a rule that you're not allowed, that the elders are not allowed to make any decision, that they have to make a decision based on how it's going to affect the Iroquois nation for the next seven generations. They can't make any decision about what's going to happen next year. It has to be for the next seven generations. We have to come up with that ethos, which is going to be a synthesis of everything and so on, that will be the basis of our understanding of what it is we're doing and why it is that we're willing to live here and why it is we're willing to fight and die and kill other people. I think it's probably, as a soldier, I think it's easier maybe dying than killing somebody. if you do it consciously. And so that's what we need to come up with, and our political system doesn't encourage that type of thought at all. And one other thing that has to come into this, which is has always been true, but now globalization makes it even much more clear, is that the idea that all of the Jewish people are going to come to Zion is not connected to reality. And maybe it's better that way. I think that everybody should come and visit. But there's two things. Most of what we know as Judaism today didn't develop in Israel. It developed in Babylon. The whole idea of afterlife is not an Israeli product. It came from Babylon, and we brought it back here. And it's very clear to see when you look at the great tombs in the first temple period before we went to Babylon, when after the people decomposed, and they would put all of the bones together in a masifa, in a central hole in the ground, because it didn't mean anything. It doesn't matter if the bones get all mixed up. After the second, during the second temple, when we came back from Babylon, and we learned about this idea of an afterlife, then it already made a difference, because I don't want to get your hip bone and you're going to get my elbow. It's not going to work. So then we started burying people separately, and then when the body decomposes, you put them in a gluskama, in a little ossuary, I think, a little box. And of course, what happened in Europe and so on and so forth. So that type of influence upon our culture is something that's very important for us, or else Judaism won't develop. And it might also be just simply practical. If in the end, one day we do lose a war, there will still be Jews someplace. They wouldn't have gotten them all, as sarcastic as that sounds. But still, it's a survival mechanism. And we're part of nature, and nature has all kinds of survival mechanisms. So in some ways, Israel is an amazing place. We've been around for 60 years. We've increased our population by 700%. More than that, actually. We've managed to fight 7, 8, 9, 10 wars, depending how you want to count them. We've produced the most high-tech agriculture, high-tech in general, medicine, water usage in the world. I mean, there isn't a cell phone in the world that doesn't use Israeli technology. There isn't a Microsoft computer in the world that doesn't use technology that's been developed in Israel. And we did all of that while maintaining a democracy, which is amazing. I don't think there's any other country in the world that's done this. And so we have a lot to be proud of. That there's a lot of problems, that's also true. Since I do programs around the world, I know that being a minority anywhere in the world is not a good place. Being a Greek in Turkey, or Turk in Greece, or being a Christian in Sudan, or being a black in America, or being an immigrant in France, it's not a good situation. You don't want to be there. You don't want to be like that anywhere. And that, so that we have problems within our democracy, that's clear. And that I would like to see it otherwise is also pretty self-evident. But all in all, that we've managed to have all of these wars, that we've managed to develop an economy, a thriving economy, that we've managed to do all of this and develop agriculture and everything else, and sciences and so on, and still maintain ourselves as a democracy, I think is mind-boggling. And there is no comparison anywhere in the world, as far as I know. I think that one of the last issues, which is difficult, I don't know if the last issue, but another issue that's very difficult for us, and it always interests me, is Israel has the highest concentration of journalists, foreign journalists in the world outside of Washington, D.C. And that's really interesting because maybe it's because of how important our economy is. Well, I highly doubt that. Then there would be more journalists in Berlin or in Beijing or something. If Germany stopped functioning, the whole world economy would go into chaos. If Israel disappears, it's not going to cause that big of a problem. I highly doubt it's because of the conflict, because if you look in terms, in objective terms, our conflict isn't even very impressive. I mean, if you count everybody who's ever been killed in the past 100 years, including the wars and including terrorism, including, people who got heart attacks because they heard something bad on the news, there's maybe 100,000 people died here. Less than that. So not even half of that. But let's say 100,000 people. Jews and Arabs together, including troops, including everybody. maybe 100,000 people. That's nothing. That's bupkis. In Rwanda, in 6 weeks, they killed 700,000 people with knives. They didn't even bother to use guns. They just hacked them apart. That's 700,000 people in 6 weeks. In 100 years, we haven't managed to kill, we haven't killed 100,000 people. In Sudan, depending who you listen to and what reports, so it's 500,000, 2 million people have been killed over the past 3 years. Any which way you look at it, it's horrendous. Not to mention other places on the globe. And so even from that point of view, even from that point of view of the conflict, we're not very good at it. I mean, there's no reason why they should be here and not in Rwanda and not in Sudan or in other places. And this scrutiny upon Israeli society, which in some ways is very good because it makes us aware of things that that might be happening that we don't want to be happening. On the other hand, it's very difficult. It's a situation where nobody else goes through. And it's also simply interesting from a sociological point of view. What is it that the globe has that's so interested in this tiny little speck of land, which is really a tiny little speck of land? It's not of any real significance, and it's not even the significance that it had in ancient times when it was a land bridge, because you don't need land bridges. You have boats and you have planes, and you can travel anywhere without having to go through here. For many years, I was very interested in the answer. I don't have an answer. For many years, the only answer I can think of was one that I really didn't like, and that was anti-Semitism. But there are countries that anti-Semitism doesn't really play a part in, like in Asia and so on. And so recently, after talking to a man named Avner Goren, who is an archaeologist, and we were talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he came up with a different paradigm. He said that Israel and the Jews, for Western society, which is more or less what sets the tone in the media, is a symbol of hope. It's a symbol of resurrection, like Jesus. And that we have managed, through all these years, to re-establish a state and revive the language and create a thriving state, and create a state that they can recognize. I mean, they don't exactly recognize Yemen. I mean, Yemen's as a country, but they don't recognize it in terms that they can understand, but Israel is a place that they can understand. So that's something they completely don't understand. They can understand. And therefore, there's a tremendous amount invested in them, for them, in what Israel does. And any blemish on that, it's like a blemish, I don't know, excuse the paraphrasing, but it's like a blemish on Jesus. It's like a blemish on that possibility of renewal and the possibility of resurrection and the possibility of there being something just and right. And therefore, they're giving us such a hard time. Instead of it being negative, that way it makes it positive. They want to see that this can be, that there is hope, and anything that we do that is detrimental to that completely unrealistic vision of hope is what bothers them. And therefore, there's so many of them here. Everybody wants to check it out because they want to see that it's a possibility, that it can happen. So living under that microscope and within what's happening now in Israeli society, we have a few challenges ahead of us.
Thank you, Amos. I think on that tone, we'll end this interview. Thank you very much.